How many of you think it's important to be on God's calendar?
I don't think I know. There's no other way.
Is there any other calendar?
That's right.
There are several calendars that coexist. Only one really marks times and seasons ordained by God. The other marks days and years, but one in particular will keep us in step with some of the things that God has ordained, not only for the telling of his specific story, but also his calendar provides us with things that can keep us out of trouble. He has set up different laws, and in those laws were things that were intended to benefit man. One of them was a Sabbath day of rest. There was something instituted by God that was created for man. Man was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. There was also something called the Sabbath year. It was the seventh year of rest for the land, that it was to remain uncultivated by human hands for 1 year. 6 years you worked the land, 7 years you let the land rest. And what happened to the nation when they turned their back on God and continued to cultivate the land, to try to extract gain from the land, resulted in judgment and exile, in which time the land was allowed to rest for all the years that they did not give it the rest that it needed. So, in all of my study and connecting things to the calendar that that God has set up, I was given a book, and I'm honestly not a big fan of like reading directly from something, but I have no way of beginning what I'm about to talk to you probably over the next month and a half, except to start with explaining the Sabbath year of rest. And I'm going to do that from a book. It's written by Jonathan Cahn. He's the same one who wrote the book The Harbinger. And there were things that God had revealed to him, 9 specific harbingers or warnings, that took place in the land of Israel right before its destruction and the captivity of Israel, and those same things were followed step by step right before, well, starting with 9/11. The very first one is where the guard of a nation is lowered, or actually the hedge of protection is lifted, to be more specific. And so in that hedge of protection being lifted, there's an attack on the nation. And then what results is our nation mirrored Israel in the fact that we stood up defiantly and said, we will rebuild. We will rebuild even stronger. And instead of repenting, turning in defiance, saying, not only do we not look to you as the one who has solemnly protected us, we're telling you by our own hands, we will rebuild even stronger. That's not good for a nation.
Nope.
So there are things that coincided with those events that I was amazed at how, I'm not going to say coincidental, just how well they lined up with God's calendar. And so we're going to start with that and looking at the Sabbath year that God instituted. If you want to look back at the Harbinger, the things that he outlined as the warning signs, you can look up this book. I'm not going to take the time to go through that. So the seventh year, The mystery begins in the Middle Eastern desert. An aged man ascends a mountain, and the mountain is shaking and appears to be on fire, with flashes of lightning and thunderous rumblings of what sounds to be a blasting trumpet. Gathered around the mountain's base are multiplied thousands of people watching in fear. The old man reaches the mountain's peak and enters the midst of a thick cloud. Within the cloud, he is given a revelation. The man is called Moshe, and will be known to much of the world as Moses. From the revelation given him will come the commandments, the moral laws, the dietary laws, the laws of cleansings, and the blueprint for the tent known as the tabernacle. The establishment of the priesthood, the sacrifices, the laws of Sabbath and holy days, and all the details that will make up the foundation upon which the nation of Israel will rest. The revelation will be called the Torah, or the law. It is from this revelation that the mystery of the Shemitah will arise. The Sabbath of years. It is well known that for the nation of Israel, every seventh day was called the Sabbath. The Sabbath was unique among the days. The Israelites were commanded to keep it separate and distinct from all other 6 days of the week. It was holy. It was the Lord's day. On the Sabbath, all regular work and all worldly endeavors were to cease. The Sabbath was a day of rest, to be devoted solely to the Lord. But what is not well known is the Sabbath was not only a day, but also a year. Every seventh day was a Sabbath day, so every seventh year was a Sabbath year. In Leviticus 25:1-4, says, "The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, When you come to the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruits. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. The Sabbath year was likewise to be kept separate and distinct from the 6 years that preceded it. It was to be a holy year, a year specifically devoted to the Lord. During the Sabbath year, there was to be no working of the land. All sowing and reaping, all plowing and planting, all gathering and harvesting had to cease by the end of the sixth year. 6 years you shall sow your land and gather its produce, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow." That's in Exodus 23:10-11. "During the Sabbath year, it was not only for the people to rest, but also the land. The fields would lie fallow, the vineyards unattended, the groves unkept. The land itself would observe its own Sabbath to the Lord. The poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the beasts of the field may eat. In like manner, you shall do with your vineyard and your olive grove." Exodus 23:11. "During the Sabbath year, the people of Israel were to leave their fields, their vineyards, and groves open for the poor for the duration of the year, and the land, and the duration of the year, the land belonged in effect to everyone. And whatever grows of its own accord was called hefker, meaning without an owner. So during the Sabbath year, the land in effect belonged to everyone and no one at the same time." Elul 29. "Just as striking as what happened to the land during the Sabbath year was what happened to the people on the last day of that year. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it from his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release." Deuteronomy 15:1-2. At the end of every 7 years refers to the last day of the Sabbath year. Elul was the last day of the month of the Hebrew civil year. The 29th day was the last day of Elul. So Elul 29, the very last day of the Sabbath year, a sweeping transformation took place in the nation's financial realm. Everyone who owed a debt was released, and every creditor had to release the debt owed. So on Elul 29, all credit was erased and all debts wiped away. The nation's financial accounts were, in effect, wiped clean. It was Israel's day of financial nullification and remission. In the Hebrew reckoning of time, each day begins not with the morning, but with the night. This goes back to Genesis 1, when the account of creation records that the first darkness, night, and then the day. So every Hebrew day begins with the night before the day. And since the night begins with the sunset, every Hebrew day begins at sunset. Therefore, the moment that all debts had to be reckoned as wiped away was the sunset of Elul 29. In English, the Elul 29 command ordains every creditor shall grant a release, but the original Hebrew command, every creditor to make a shmita. In those first two verses of Deuteronomy 15, the word shmita appears no less than four times. At the end of the second verse, it is written, because it is called the Lord's release. In Hebrew, it is called the Lord's shmita. The word shmita is not often translated the release, the word shmita is most often translated as the release or the remission. The English word remission is defined as the cancellation or reduction of a debt or penalty. The shmita of ancient Israel refers not only to the releasing of the land, but also to the nullification of debt and credit ordained by God and performed on a massive nationwide scale. Shmita became the name of the last day of the Sabbath year, Elul 29, the day of remission. But it also became the name of the Sabbath year in its entirety. The seventh year would become known as the year of the Shemitah, or simply, the Shemitah. The year of the Shemitah would begin with the releasing of the land and end with the day of remission, when the people would themselves be released. So, the word Shemitah covers both the seventh year and the day of the last day of that year. There's a reason for that. The last day of Elul 29 is the year's crescendo, its peak, its culmination, the remission of the year of remission. In a sense, everything about the Shemitah year builds up to that final day when everything is released, remitted, and wiped away all in one day, or more specifically, to the eve of that day, to the final sunset. The radical ramifications. The idea of a nation ceasing all work on its land for an entire year is a radical proposition. No less radical is the idea of a day in which all credit and debt are wiped away. The ramifications of these two requirements are so great that concerns arose in the later generations as to the Shemitah's financial and economic consequences. These concerns were intensified when the Jewish people returned to their land, to the land of Israel in modern times. In order to resolve these concerns, the rabbis sought to come up with ways of avoiding the Shemitah's more radical requirements. One of these was based on the idea that the Shemitah applied primarily to Jewish-owned land. So, in the year of the Shemitah, Jewish farmers would sell their lands to non-Jews and continue to work. The selling would be done under an agreement in which the land would revert to the Jewish farmer at the end of the Shemitah year. In the same way, the rabbis devised ways to get around the cancellation of debts. The rabbinical sage Hillel developed a system whereby debts could be transferred to a religious court. Since a court is not an individual, the debt would survive the year of the Shemitah. Still others came up with other strategies around it. So the Shemitah continued to be observed in one form or another, but those forms became increasingly symbolic. Not everyone accepted these methods. Orthodox Jews in Israel tell stories of Jewish farmers who faithfully kept the Shemitah's requirements without any alteration and ended up with an extra abundant harvest the following year. Regardless of the controversy surrounding them, the fact that these methods were devised by the rabbis reveals two things that will prove important in unlocking the mystery of the Shemitah. Number one, the Shemitah bears consequences that specifically affect the financial and economic realm. And number two, the effects of the Shemitah bear key similarities to the effects of economic and financial collapse. The call of the Shemitah. What is the reason for the Shemitah in the first place? There are several answers, all of which touch the spiritual realm. The Shemitah bears witness that the land, and for that matter, the earth, belongs to God. This is important.
That's huge, absolutely.
Would you do me a favor? In my Bible, it doesn't spell that word out. Would you spell it for me?
Yes, S-H-E-M-I-T-A-H. The Shemitah bears witness that the land, and for that matter, the earth, belong to God. It is only entrusted to man as a steward. God is sovereign. His sovereignty extends also to the realms of money, finances, economies, and possessions. These are entrusted to man's keeping, but ultimately belong to God. The Shemitah declares that God is first and above all realms of life, and must therefore be put first and above every realm. During the Shemitah, Israel was, in effect, compelled to turn away from earthly and worldly realms and turn to the spiritual. The Shemitah cleanses and wipes away, ends imbalances, levels accounts, and nullifies that which was built up in the previous years. A massive cleansing of the financial and economic slate. It ends entanglements and brings release. Its release applies not only to the land and to the nation's financial accounts, but also to something much more universal. The Shemitah requires the people to release their attachments to the material realm, their possessions, their finances, their real estate, and their claims and pursuits concerning such things. It is the breaking of bonds, and those who restore are likewise released, no longer possessed by their possessions, but free. The Shemitah is a reminder that God is the source of all blessings, spiritual and physical alike. But when God is removed from the picture, the removal of blessing will ultimately follow. The Shemitah thus deals with a particular flaw of human nature, the tendency to divorce the blessings of life from the giver of those blessings, to divorce the physical realm from the spiritual. It then seeks to compensate for the loss of the spiritual by increasing its claims over the physical world. Pursuing more and more things, increase, gain, materialism. This increase of things, in turn, further crowds out the presence of God. The Shemitah is the antidote to all of these things, the cleansing away of material attachments to allow the work and presence of God to come in. The observance of the Shemitah is an act of submission and humility. It is the acknowledgement that every good thing comes from God and cannot ultimately be owned, only received as an entrustment. Possessions are let go, accounts are wiped out. That which has been built up is wiped away. The Shemitah humbles the pride of man. Lastly, the Shemitah shares the attributes of the Sabbath day, an entire year given to rest and let rest, to release and be released, to unburden others and lay one's burdens down, to wipe clean the slate and have one's own slate wiped clean, the time appointed by God for rest, refreshing, and revival. Before we move on, let's take stock of what is now known about the first key. These are the puzzle pieces that will become critical to unlock the mystery of the Shemitah. The Shemitah is 2 years, what the Sabbath is to days. It takes place once every 7 years. It is unique and distinct from the 6 years that precede it. It is the year of cessation, release, and rest, the ceasing of what has not ceased up to the time of its coming. The Shemitah specifically touches the financial and economic realms. It leads up and builds to its climactic final day, Elul 29, the day of remission, the day of nullification. On Elul 29, all debts are canceled and credit released, and the nation's financial accounts are transformed and wiped clean. The Shemitah is sweeping, radical, and extreme. Its effects, consequences, and repercussions bear key similarities to that of financial and economic collapse.
That'll bring you there one way or the other, won't it?
What we're going to see if we look at God's calendar is key times in our own nation's history that just absolutely paralleled the wiping of the economic slate.
Did you really read that last sentence?
The effects, consequences, and repercussions bear key similarities to that of financial and economic collapse.
We wonder why we get ourselves in a mess and we don't even understand it's right there.
That's why last Sunday, when I was talking about how when we follow the traditions of men, specifically, I was talking about December 25th, celebrating Christ's birth on December 25th as a tradition of men. And what that's done is it's gotten our eyes off of God's calendar. Yes, it has its consequences. The Shemitah, like the Sabbath day, was intended to be a blessing for the nation of Israel. The words, concepts most associated with it, the release, the remission, the forgiveness of debt, are all positive. But the mystery of the Shemitah concerns judgment. This raises an important and obvious question. How could something intended to be a national blessing become linked to a national judgment? Let's take it one step further. How could something intended to be a national blessing transform into a national judgment? In the next chapter, we'll find the second key to the answer. Remember Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, when he went through and he found the city barren. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow is she who was great among the nations. All her gates are desolate. Her children have gone into captivity. Lamentations 1:1-5. The prophet walks in the midst of the ruins of the fallen city, what was once the capital of his nation. The city of kings and princes now lies in ashes and rubble. The streets are desolate. The city upon which rested the name and the glory of God is destroyed. The land of Zion, is left desolate. He had not been silent. He had sounded the alarm and warned his nation over and over again, but they had rejected the warning and the bearer of that warning. They persecuted him and placed him in prison. And then the calamity of which he had long prophesied finally happened. The kingdom was no more. Gone was the temple. Gone were the priests. Gone was the nation that had known, that he had known and loved. The year was 586 BC. The city was Jerusalem. The kingdom was Judah. And the prophet was named Jeremiah. He wept not only for the city and the land, but also for his people. The city was desolate. Its fields were abandoned. Men, women, and children were taken captive into exile into the land of those who had wrought the destruction. Now, by the rivers of Babylon, they sat down and wept. The mystery of the 70 years. Jeremiah had prophesied all of it, the destruction and the exile. In fact, the Lord had revealed to him the length of the judgment, the exact number of years. And the Lord has sent you, all of his servants, the prophets, but you have not listened nor inclined your ears to hear. They said, repent now, everyone, all of his evil way and his evil doings, and dwell in the land of the Lord that he has given you and your fathers forever and ever. Therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, because you have not heard my words, the whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Jeremiah 25, 4 through 11. According to Jeremiah's prophecy, for 70 years the nation would be under domination, under dominion of Babylon. At the end of the appointed time, the Lord would cause Babylon to fall and the exiles to return to Zion. The prophecy would come true in 539 BC with the fall of the Babylonian Empire and the rise of the Persians led by King Cyrus. Cyrus would issue a decree granting the exiled Jewish people the right to return and rebuild their land. But why 70 years? The reason is deeply rooted in a mystery more ancient still. As long as she lays desolate. The book of 2 Chronicles sheds more light on the same destruction and exile which Jeremiah prophesied. And the Lord God of their fathers sent warnings to them by his messengers. But they mocked the messengers of God, despised his words, and scoffed his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people, till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought against them the king of the Chaldeans. They burned the house of God, broke down the walls of Jerusalem, and burned all its palaces with fire. 2 Chronicles 36, 15 through 19. The account goes on to speak of those carried away into exile, and the missing key appears. And those who escaped from the sword were he carried away to Babylon, where they became servants to him and his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths. As long as she lay desolate, she kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. 2 Chronicles 36, 20 through 21. Until the land had enjoyed her Sabbaths is a very strange and striking statement. How does a land enjoy its Sabbaths? And what could this possibly have to do with the 70 years of judgment? The answer is found in the deserts of Sinai. I'm going to take a side note. Do you know that our mineral depletion is so extreme that it's causing, it's like one of the root causes of most ailments in Americans.
Yeah.
And we're putting back into the ground nitrogen and I can't remember all the different elements that are
usually
in.
Usually only three.
And fertilizer, but we're not putting back in the trace elements. And yeah. And so we're depleting.
And the reason why, again, it speaks back to greed again. The only reason why they put those three in is because those are the ones that make the fruit and the vegetables grow big and look good. It's all about appearance, and the people will buy. It's
right.
Marketing.
Yeah.
The only reason why they put those three are the ones that are necessary for the produce to grow big and to be marketable. It's about money.
Anyway.
This is a picture of how we are to God, how he sees us. I'm thinking, oh God.
I really hope that that this will open up your hearts to what we're going to be discovering over the next month, because I believe that this year specifically speaks to things that we all have to look at in our own lives, take account of, and I believe this is to be a year of release for us.
Amen.
Well, not just for those things that we are in bondage to, but to those that we're holding bondage
over.
Yeah. Our bodies bear the resemblance of the earth that was created.
Yeah.
And the laws that govern this earth also govern our physical bodies, you know. So if we hold on to things, and you know, I've said this in different ways in different messages, but when we hold on to things, it festers into unnatural, unhealthy things on the inside of us. I was going through my grandfather's garage, and there's on one side, it was computer books, you know, that had been bought over the period of about 20 years. On the right side was all the stuff that was taken out of the drugstore in the final days when we had to get out of the building. The building was sold. We had like a week left. We just had to do a final sweep, and that was put into the garage. In the back, on the wall that on the other side is the inside of the house, that was all from Kay's residence. When she had passed away, he didn't know what to do with her stuff. It all got boxed up. It got brought into the house. Well, because that stuff never saw air, never saw the light of day, it was subject to all kinds of unhealthy, creepy crawlies. And it was total deterioration. It became worthless because it never saw the light of day. It was stored. It was harbored. You know what I'm saying? So when we take those things internally that we need to air out, that we need to let go, and we bury them inside so that they never see air or the light of day, it produces in us the same thing. It's destruction. Okay. The Torah clue. In Leviticus 26, a prophecy is given on what would happen to the people of Israel if they turned away from God. They would be removed from the land and scattered to the nations. The prophecy would come true in 586 BC with the destruction of Jerusalem. But it is here in the Torah that the vital connection is revealed. I will lay your cities waste and bring your sanctuaries to desolation. I will bring the land to desolation. Your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbaths as long as it lies desolate and you are in your enemy's land. Then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it shall rest. For that time, it did not rest on your Sabbath when you dwelt in it. In other words, because you didn't give it the rest, I will. That's Leviticus 26, 31 through 35. The Sabbaths of the land is referred in this passage are Sabbath years, the Shemitahs. In other words, the Shemitah would hold the key to the timing of the Lord's judgments. But why and how? The covenant sign. The Shemitah was a sign of the nation's covenant with God. Everything they had, the land and all its blessings, was dependent on the covenant and their relationship with God. It was all entrusted to them, but it belonged to God. If they turned away from God, then their blessings would be removed, or rather, they would be removed from their blessings. So for the people of Israel, to keep the Sabbath year was to acknowledge God's sovereignty over their land and lives. It was also an act of faith. It required their total trust in God's faithfulness to provide for their needs while they ceased from farming. In the same way, to cancel all debts owed them was to sacrifice monetary gain, and again, to rely on God's providence. Lastly, the keeping of the Shemitah was above all an act of devotion and worship, to put God above everything else in one's life. But for all this, a blessing was promised. If Israel would keep the Shemitah, God would keep and bless Israel with all that was needed and beyond. The broken Shemitah. On the other hand, to abandon or reject the Shemitah would signify the opposite. The breaking of the covenant and the rejection of God's sovereignty over the land and lives, it would be as if they said, the land does not belong to God, but to us. Our blessings, our possessions, everything we have in our lives comes not from God, but from the work of our own hands. Nor does it belong to God, but to us. We will not sacrifice profit or gain for the sake of pursuing God, nor will we allow anything to halt or interrupt these pursuits. We have no need, no time, and no room for God in our lives or in the life of our nation. So the matter of the Shemitah was critical. Upon it rested the nation's future. The Shemitah and the fall of a nation. Israel's rejection of the Shemitah set in motion a series of far-reaching consequences and repercussions. If God is not sovereign over the land and its people, then the land and its people become cut off from the Creator. A God-centered worldview is replaced by a man-centered and self-centered worldview. So the people of Israel drove God out of their lives to become their own gods, masters of the land, their world, and their destiny. They could now rewrite the law and redefine what was right and wrong, moral and immoral. Without God, nothing would be holy, or, for that matter, unholy. Nothing had any purpose except for the purpose they now assigned it. And with no true purpose, they could do whatever they wanted, not only with their land, but also with their lives, with each other, and with their children. And thus they lifted up their children in sacrifices on the altars of foreign gods. It was for this last transgression that the judgment finally fell. It began with the breaking of the Shemitah and ended in the offering of their sons and their daughters on the fires of Baal and Molech, the sin that would bring about the nation's destruction. 1973. When the judgment fell in 586 BC, the holy city would be left a burning ruin. The Holy Land, a vast desolation, and the people captives in a foreign land. What does this have to do with the Shemitah? The nation had driven God out of their lives and the Shemitah from their land. Now it would return to them. But they had refused to observe freely and now come upon them. What they had refused to observe freely would now come upon them by force. It would come back at them, not in the form of blessing, but of judgment. They had driven out the Shemitah from the land. Now the Shemitah had returned, and they themselves were driven out. They had removed God from their lives. Now their blessings would likewise be removed from their lives, and their lives from their blessings. The Shemitah's desolations. During the Shemitah, there are to be no sowing or reaping of the land. The nation had rejected the ordinance and had worked the land continuously, exploiting it for gain. But when the Shemitah had returned to the land in the form of judgment, all sowing and reaping ceased. All tending of vineyards and groves came to an end, and no one worked the land. Through judgment and calamity, the ordinance was now fulfilled. During the Shemitah, everyone who owned a vineyard or grove had to open it up to those in need. Every field had to now be accessible to the poor. The gates of the walled and fenced lands were unlocked and left open the entire year. In the destruction of 586 BC, the gates were opened by force. Walls were broken down, fences were destroyed, vineyards were exposed, groves were left unprotected, and private land became public and accessible to all. In the judgment, the Shemitah was fulfilled. On the Shemitah's last and climactic day, all debt was canceled and all credit annulled, and the nation's financial accounts were transformed in a massive nullification. In 586 BC, the nation's financial accounts were, likewise, transformed in a massive wiping away of the nation's financial realm. The calamity canceled and wiped out debt and nullified credit by force. As it had always done, the Shemitah had transformed the nation's financial realm, and now by the force of destruction. The effect of the Shemitah was to wipe away that which had been built up. In 586 BC, the Shemitah wiped away the kingdom itself, that which had been built up. The nation's palaces and towers were all wiped away. The kingdom itself had been nullified. The severe Sabbath. The Shemitah was the Sabbath of years, the year of rest, of fallow ground, of unkept vineyards, of stillness. In 586 BC, the years that followed, with the people in exile, the land of Israel rested. Its fields lay fallow, its groves unkept, its vineyards unattended, its threshing floors silent, its olive trees abandoned, its vine presses still. What was ordained from Sinai was now fulfilled. Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbath as long as it lies desolate, and you are in your enemy's hands. Then the land shall rest and enjoy her Sabbaths. There had been a total of 70 Sabbath or Shemitah years in the nation that had not been observed. So Israel's judgment would last 70 years. So, I mean, it was 490, but I mean, in that time, 70 Sabbath years were not observed. Yeah. As long as it lies desolate, it shall rest for the time that it did not rest on your Sabbaths when you dwelt in it. So the mystery of the Shemitah was held, or that held the secret of the timing of the nation. It was the mystery of the Shemitah that held the secret of the timing of the nation's judgment. The Shemitah and world history. The judgment that fell on the land of Israel in 586 BC was a pivotal event in biblical history, Jewish history, and world history. In the Temple of Jerusalem, in the Temple of Jerusalem would be destroyed and the words of the Hebrew prophets fulfilled. In it, the diaspora, or the scattering of the Jewish people throughout the world, would begin and the stage would be set for the formation of what would be known as Judaism and the coming of a Jewish rabbi named Yeshua, or Jesus, whose life would irrevocably change the history of the world. And behind it all was the mystery of the Shemitah. In other words, this obscure, little-known, ancient mystery had already affected the entire planet and those who live on it in ways too vast to measure. But could there be more? Could the mystery of the Shemitah still be at work, moving, impacting, and altering the course of world history, even the modern world in our day? If so, what form would it take on? How would the Shemitah manifest in the modern world? For the answer, another key is needed. How long have we been doing this?
It doesn't matter. Keep going.
Don't stop.
That's right.
According to the book of 2 Chronicles, the mystery of the Shemitah was operating behind one of the most pivotal events in world history, the destruction of the kingdom in 586 BC. But what if the mystery was still in effect? Or what if it was to manifest again in the modern world? What if it was operating right now, still touching, affecting, determining, or altering the course of human mystery in our modern times? What would it look like? The Shemitah's economic connection. In modern economies, a very small percentage of people work the land, gather and harvest, or tend vineyards. So how could the Shemitah break the barrier to operate in the modern world? What happens if we look at the effects and consequences of the Shemitah in purely technical and general terms? The result is not only relevant, but also surprisingly applicable to our day. The effect and the repercussions of the Shemitah extend into the nation's financial realm, economic realm, the realms of labor, employment, production, consumption, and trade. Though most modern economies are not centered on agriculture, but purely are industrial and post-industrial, all of these attributes still apply. Thus, if the Shemitah was to manifest in modern times, it would affect a nation's financial realm, its economic realm, and its realms of labor, employment, production, consumption, and trade.
Absolutely.
Pretty much. Over the course of the Shemitah, the nation's production is severely decreased. For a modern nation to witness a severe decreasing in its production would point to an economic downturn or recession, an economic collapse or a depression. During such times, demands dry up, corporations downsize, factories cut back on output, and businesses close their doors. During the Shemitah, the nation's labor is greatly reduced or come to a cessation. In the case of a modern nation, this would translate to massive unemployment. All of these, again, are characteristics of an economic recession or depression. During the Shemitah, the buying and selling of the land's produce are restricted, and the fruits of labor are abandoned. Here, we have yet another characteristic of economic recessions and collapses. Demands dry up, consumption plunges, commerce dwindles, consumers cut back on their spending, and merchandise sits untouched in stores and warehouses, and internal trade suffers massive declines. The fruits and products of the nation's industry and services are abandoned. Financial collapse. On its climactic day, Elul 29, the force of the Shemitah causes credit to be canceled and debt to be wiped away. The nation's financial accounts are transformed, nullified, and wiped clean. The description, again, points us to an economic implosion and, more specifically, to financial collapse. Such collapses produce corporate failures, bank failures, foreclosures, and bankruptcies. Debt and credit are nullified, and in financial crises involving stock market crashes, financial accounts are transformed, nullified, and wiped clean. Billions of dollars wiped away in a matter of hours or minutes. The effects or consequences of the Shemitah consistently point in the direction of a specific event, an economic and financial collapse. The resemblance of the Shemitah to an economic implosion has been noted even by the rabbis. The Shemitah, observances and cataclysms. On one hand, we have the Shemitah as a biblically ordained occurrence, a religious event, a Sabbath rest, and a blessing carried out through the voluntary observance of God's people. On the other hand, we have the destruction of a kingdom, an event that comes through a multitude of causes entirely from having nothing to do with voluntary religious observance. How can the two be connected? The Bible itself establishes a connection in Leviticus 26 when it speaks of military invasion of such magnitude that it reduces entire cities to ruins and the land to depopulate devastation. And yet, it speaks of the land's desolation as the fulfillment of the Shemitah. The Shemitah in modern times. So, regardless of the means by which it comes, the ultimate result is the same. It is the effect of the Shemitah that manifests, whether through voluntary observance of God's people or by calamitous event. The sowers and reapers of ancient Israel were to voluntarily cease from working for the duration of the Shemitah. In the modern world, economic downturns and implosions force people from employment and labor. The means are different, but the end result is the same. In the ancient Shemitah, the voluntary abandoning of fields and groves meant that the land's yield and productivity plummeted. In the modern world, the plummeting of production and yield are caused by economic collapses. In the ancient Shemitah, the people were not to buy, sell, or partake in the fruit of the land. In the modern world, economic collapses cause the plunging of consumption and trade. And in the ancient Shemitah, the people were to wipe clean their financial accounts by the canceling out of debt and credit. In the modern world, financial collapses cause credit to fail, debts to go unpaid, and financial accounts to be wiped out. Sowing and reaping in the modern world. It is striking to note how many agricultural terms connected with the Shemitah are also linked to the economic and financial realms. Financial investment is called sowing, and the funding given to launch a financial enterprise is called seed money. The starting of a new enterprise is called planting. When a financial investment produces returns, those returns are called the yield. The yield is part of its coming to fruition. Then one reaps the yield. The connection is just as strong in ancient Hebrew. And in one of those ordinances of the Shemitah, it is written, "And if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow nor gather in produce?" Leviticus 25:20. Beyond the English word produce is the Hebrew word tebua. Tebua can be translated as fruit and produce, but is also gain, income, and revenue. Here, as before, we find a connection to the Shemitah in the economic realm. The Shemitah impacts a nation's material blessings, that which makes up its prosperity, its productivity, and its sustenance. In modern nations, it translates the economic and financial realms. So, if the Shemitah is to operate in the modern world, we would expect it to be especially linked to those same realms. And since the nature of the Shemitah is to bring about cessation, this would translate to an economic or financial collapse. The Shemitah as a prophetic sign. But can the manifestation of the Shemitah go even further? Can it extend beyond the economic realm? Can it manifest in other forms of cessation, collapse, or even destruction? The answer is found in the account of 2 Chronicles concerning calamity that fell upon the land in 586 BC. According to the account, the Babylonian invasion of the land, the burning of Jerusalem, the exile of the people from the land, are all part of the manifesting of the Shemitah. This presents a jarring fusion. On one hand, the Shemitah, a religious observance of rest, the Sabbath year. On the other hand, it is a national cataclysm that sets a city on fire and wipes away an entire kingdom. The one is all about release. The other, a nation taken by force into captivity and exile. How do these two jarring realities go together? The answer is, they don't go together. They are one and the same. According to the account, that which fell upon the land of Israel in 586 BC was not just connected to the Shemitah, it was the Shemitah. As long as she lay desolate, she kept her Sabbath. 2 Chronicles 36:21. The destruction was the Shemitah. All the unkept, unobserved, and unfulfilled Shemitahs from Israel's past were now returning to find their fulfillment. The 70 years of judgment were the 70 unkept Shemitahs from Israel's past. The Shemitah had returned in an altered form. It had transformed. It was now operating through conflict and war, political alliance, and the deportation and exile of an entire people, and the countless variables of human actions, reactions, and interactions. The Shemitah and the two empires. The Shemitah lay behind the march of Babylonian armies into the Promised Land, the burning of the temple, the removal of the people from the land, and their years in exile. It operated on an epic scale, transcending the boundaries of ancient Israel and involving foreign peoples, nations, and empires. In order for the land to rest and keep its missed Sabbaths, the Jewish people had to be removed from their land. In order for the Jewish people to be removed from the land, the Babylonian Empire had to ascend onto the world stage. In order for the Babylonian Empire to ascend, the Assyrian Empire had to fall. Once the land kept its Sabbaths, the Babylonian captivity would come to an end. In order for that to happen, another empire had to rise, that of Persia. Thus, the Babylonian Empire happens to rise at the time the 70 years of the Shemitah must commence. Then, when the 70 years of the Shemitah are complete, it falls. It falls because the empire of Persia rises. Thus, the Persian Empire happens to rise at the same time the Shemitah draws to their end. The mystery of the Shemitah thus becomes global, affecting the course of nations beyond and far removed from Israel, and causing the rise and fall of powers, kingdoms, and world empires. Yes?
Can you interject something real quick? That's one of the things that I've been saying over and over again when it came to do with when we talked about who's in office. The God is the one that orchestrates these things.
That's right.
We don't think that he does, but he does.
He does.
He is the one that sets up the boundaries and the duration of every nation. It says so in the scriptures. He's the one that created all those things. And he does it for his purposes. God rarely gets what he wants, but he always gets his purposes. He wants for Israel, in those examples you're reading, to do it with all of their heart and to keep the Shemitah. But if they don't, the Shemitah is still going to be kept. But not the way he wanted. His will wasn't made, it wasn't fulfilled, but his purpose was.
Yeah.
His purposes will always be fulfilled.
Yes.
His will rarely is.
Yes.
But I think that it's important that we see that, because, you know, it's just like you're, which I know you're getting towards, this is why we are where we are. And but I think there's also another dividing line, and that is that the Shemitah is a representation of a characteristic of God. And so, therefore, it's kind of like on a time, it's on autopilot, and kind of take care of itself. Whereas, as far as judgment, that's a separate issue, because God's judgment is actually on the body of Christ right now, not the world. So the world is going to be affected, like the Babylonians and like the Persians and the Assyrians were affected by the law of the Shemitah being in place, and we're still going to be affected by that. But God's active judgment is not with the world, though the world being affected by his pre-established laws, judgment itself is only taking place with the body right now.
Right.
So you got two things overlapping and working together.
Right. Judgment begins with the house of God.
Absolutely.
Yes, right.
And until we're out of here, their judgment won't start.
Right.
So anyway, I appreciate you.
God helps
giving you a chance.
I wouldn't want to be here then.
Does the mystery of the Shemitah always involve judgment? Not necessarily. Nor is it a simplistic equation whereby every manifestation can neatly be attributed to a particular sin. And as we have seen, the same manifestation can mean the fall of one power and the rise of another. The Shemitah forms an underlying pattern and dynamic that, given the right circumstances, will manifest in a specific way. Its manifestations may vary in form, but will exhibit consistent characteristics, operate through consistent dynamic, and produce consistent repercussions. Given the circumstance of a nation or civilization dedicated to, from its inception to the will of God, but now in departure from that will, in defiance of his ways, and at war with his sovereignty, as it was with ancient Israel, the Shemitah will increasingly, more intensely, and more severely manifest in the direction of judgment. At the beginning of this chapter, I proposed a question as to what the mystery of the Shemitah would look like if it were operating in the modern world. To now answer that question, let us assemble the pieces of the puzzle. The overall manifestation. The Shemitah declares God's sovereignty, dominion, and ownership over all things. It specifically touches the realm of a nation's prosperity and sustenance. It manifests the Sabbath year, and it's distinct from the 6 years preceding it. It bears witness that all blessings come from God. It humbles the pride of man. It lays bare man's total dependence on God. It separates wealth and possessions from the owner. It wipes away that which has built up in the previous years. It levels imbalance and erases accounts. It causes cessation, pauses, interruptions, and endings. It reveals the link between physical, material realm and the spiritual realm. It bears witness against materialism. It calls the nation to turn away from material pursuits and to the spiritual. It releases entanglements, attachments, and bondages. It brings about rest or Sabbath. It calls a nation back to God, if the nation will listen.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
the economic manifestations. The Shemitah carries a special connection and bears special consequences on a nation's economic realm. Its effect and repercussions extend to the realms of labor production, employment, revenue, consumption, trade, and finances. It causes production to cease or severely decrease. It causes labor to cease or be greatly reduced. It causes the private realm to increasingly yield to the public realm, and private ownership to be increasingly subject to public necessities. It causes buying and selling, the transactions of commerce, to be greatly curtailed. It builds up to its peak day, the day of remission, on Elul 29. It causes a nation's financial accounts to be transformed, annulled, and wiped clean. It causes credit to be unpaid and debt released. Credit and debt are wiped away. It acts as an economic and financial leveler, wiping out that which has been allowed to build up in the preceding years, nullifying imbalance. It erases accounts and causes release and remission in the account and financial, in the economic and financial realms. The prophetic manifestation. The Shemitah is also a prophetic sign of a national judgment. To a nation that has rejected the sovereignty of God, a nation that no longer sees itself as under God, to a nation that has driven God out of its culture, to a nation that has divorced its blessings from the hand of God, to a nation that pursues increase and prosperity above righteousness and over God, to a nation that seeks material blessing or pleasure as an end in and of itself, to a nation that once knew God but has now largely forgotten him, to a nation that once knew the ways of God but now rejects them, upon a nation that specifically strikes the nation's blessings, or that nation's blessings, prosperity, and sustenance, that bears witness to the nation that all of its blessings came from God, and without him those blessings cannot remain but will be removed. That bears witness against the nation's materialism, that strikes the nation's economic realm, that wipes out the nation's financial accounts, that humbles the nation and casts down its objects of pride and glory, that separates wealth and possession from that nation, that causes cessation, pauses, interruptions, and endings, that releases entanglements, attachment, bondages among the people of a nation, that lays bare the nation's total dependence on God, that holds the key to the specific timing of national judgment, that directs the nation away from the worldly and material, and that calls the nation back to God. The global manifestation. Yes.
I just want to make sure I'm getting all this is a lot off one time. That God's looking to us as his children. If we do not respond to this, it's going to affect the rest of the world, but the rest of the world can't do anything about it. We're the ones that have to respond to God because we're the ones that have sinned. Is this correct now?
Correct. Okay. So the instruction was given to Israel. Mm-hmm. And if Israel didn't keep what God had commanded them, then it resulted in affecting nations. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the command was given to Israel.
Right. Okay, I just want to make sure I was straight.
The Shemitah, in its most far-reaching manifestation, operates on an epic and global scale, transcending national borders and involving every realm of life. It involves not only the economic and financial realm, but also the political, the cultural, and the sociological realm, the military realm, and even the natural realm. Though directly impacting the financial and economic realms, its outworkings can be triggered or accompanied by events entirely of different realms. It can manifest in the form of a cataclysmic event. It can wipe away not only financial accounts, but also physical realities, buildings, walls, towers, and cities. It can alter the landscape of nations and powers. And it can involve and affect the rise and fall of great powers and determine the course of empires. We have now identified the dynamics and nature of the Shemitah as a pattern and template, as well as a sign of national judgment. But one question remains. In ancient times, the focal point of the Shemitah was the nation and land of Israel. If the Shemitah was to manifest in the modern world, on what stage would it operate? Where would it play out? To answer that question, we need one more clue.
That's excellent.
It gets more intense from there. When we start looking at all the different events that happened in our nation's economy and lined up with God's calendar, we're going to see that not only have we failed in keeping that basically all the blessings that God entrusted to us were for a specific purpose. And not only have we misused the blessings of God, we have separated those blessings from His hand of giving them. You know what I'm saying? As a nation.
Yes.
And it's only going to cause further collapse in our economy. Yes, Doris?
I don't know. Yeah, I didn't hear you mention it, but you might have. And I just missed it. But I was looking. And it said that September 24th of 2014 was when the Shemitah began. And it will end September 13th of 2015.
Yes. This is a Shemitah year.
And in regards to that, like the gentleman said, it's not the dates that's significant. It's what we do in regards to returning to God and getting our hearts straight and repenting.
The reason why I think that this message is so important is because of that, is because this year, if we understand that, if each of us individually understand that, and we seek to honor God instead of our own pursuits, then I think that'll make all the difference in the world in our own personal lives and what God is allowed to do or able to do through us. So the question is, are we going to continue our own pursuits and find ourselves in captivity? Or are we going to honor God with all that He's entrusted to us and become a blessing to those around us?
I would say that's one more reason why, as we have been commanded, to pray for those who have authority over us.
Absolutely.
There are big changes on the horizon, and I think if we don't, we'll be remiss.
Yes, Ms. Terry.
Practically speaking, numbers, of course, popped out to me, and of course the thing, which I'm sure you'll get to in more of your things, but I just thought it was interesting. I keep hearing the word, the recession of 2008, the recession of 2008, and 2008 was 7 years
ago. Yes, it was.
And 7 years before that, it was 2001, when September 11th happened.
The interesting thing is, I know, I mean, I'm going to revisit that again, but September 11th was 7 days before Elul 29, and the New York Stock Exchange was closed from September 11th to September 18th for that entire week until Elul 29, and on that day, there was the largest collapse that we had seen in our nation's history.
We're not listening. The other thing I wanted to share just hit me as you were talking a minute ago about, you know, recognizing it is a Shemitah year and what that applies to and how God's going to work and what we need to be doing to do what God wants us to do during this year. And it just hit me because I'm just so grateful because last week I felt like the Lord gave me a word for this year. A single word, and I actually started studying it this week, and that word is honor.
What?
Honor. Okay, you had something, and then we're going to close.
Yes. I have felt for quite a while that something was going to happen this year. I didn't know what. But I think, like what you're saying, is we're going to look to be delivered out of what's going to happen around us, and we probably will be affected by it. So, let me finish. So it's not in the possessions that we own. It's not in the safety that we think we have. It's who we trust.
Right.
And the honor that we're going to give Him through it all. Are we going to moan and complain and say, oh God, you know, deliver us out of this? Or are we going to go through this cleansing of self and all the things that hold us?
Yes.
And as always, it depends on us.
Right. So let me just end with this one statement. Examine this week the things that have a hold on you. That's all I'm going to say. You want one final thing?
What I meant to say earlier, but I couldn't remember whether I wanted to be assured that it was in Scripture. was one of the examples that you were giving, again, of the nations rising and falling. And again, two things are at stake here that God's dealing with. He's dealing with the representation of his character and his ways in the Shemitah. I believe probably one of the things he's representing is the sovereignty and his ownership of all things. And so therefore, that's got to be, it's holy. And therefore, God has to maintain it. He has to protect it. But its connection with his people, he also was rescuing his people through the middle of it. And so even when he ejects his people out of the land so that the land he's given them will observe the Sabbath, he does it, of course, to maintain the integrity of the representation of his character on the earth, which is the Shemitahs in this area, but also to redeem his people. And so you see God planning the rising up and the falling of these various nations, all for the very purpose of, God's focus has always been on, at that point, was always on Israel. Now his focus is on the church, not on Israel. But at the time, the church was Israel, so to speak. And so God, everything that happened on this planet was centered around what God was doing with Israel. So the Babylonian Empire rose up and it fell. The Assyrian rose and fell, all because of what God was doing with Israel. And this passage here kind of says that in Isaiah 43. It says, "But now, this is what the Lord says, he who created you, Jacob, and he who formed you, Israel, do not fear, for I have redeemed you. I have summoned you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I will give Egypt for your ransom, Cush and Seba.